Hi, and welcome to Rule of Carnage. This is where myself, Glenn Ford, have conversations with this guy, Mike Hutchinson. We're a couple of games designers, and we chat about how to design better games, better miniatures games. And today we're going to have a little conversation about, we're calling complexity budget and cognitive load. What sort of pressures are too much upon your poor players, meet computer, how to lessen the pressures on them both learning the game and also playing the game, where those pressures are good and lovely and it's nice to sort of have some chunky weight upon your head meat, and where it's just unpleasant grind and you can't handle it the game. Now, I have in my opinion, what I mean by cognitive load and complexity budget is the complexity budget is when a player approaches a game, they come to it with a certain amount of complexity they can handle whilst learning the game, and you have to spend that complexity on the rules of your game in a way that is intelligent and useful, and you get the most joy and fun and crunchy interestingness out of the rules without exhausting your player's complexity budget. And they just go, nope, that's it. There's too much gubbins here. I'm not giving headspace to this and putting it to one side. And by cognitive load, I mean that when you are playing the game at the table, which things are taking the weight of your brain's calculation that aren't fun, interesting, intricate bits on the tabletop. You know, where am I going? Okay, I've just got to remember the number 8 for the next 5 minutes. I just have to do that. It's not fun. It's not interesting. It's not part of cool calculations. It's just a little gremlin in my brain pan. Those seem like relatively decent ways to split the conversation.
Yeah, no, I think so. I'm pretty sure that these definitions float. I think these are your definitions, and I'm going to adopt them. So let's make them our definitions. I haven't gone and looked these up to find out if they exist in the real world, but let's just use them, because I think that having something about learning the game and having something about operating the game is super, super important to try and prize apart. So yeah, I'm good with these. Let's kick them.
Yeah, so beginning with complexity budget, I think that's a term that I've possibly bought over from board game design. That's one of the ways that a few well-known board game designers refer to the cost that you put upon your player as they learn their game. And one of the major things to consider about complexity budget is innovation and how good, how much innovation is within game design. You know, you want your game to be innovative. You want it to be different. You want it to not be like everybody else's game. But there's a definite point where there is such a thing as too much innovation. Part of that is simply, you know, you do come across some game designs, sometimes from more inexperienced designers, that you can see them reinventing the wheel sort of over and over again, and you know, in unnecessary ways, and you just sort of think, like, why am I what you're doing, the upshot of what these rules are doing is exactly the same as everybody else's rule about movement or shooting, whatever it happens to be. It's exactly the same sort of set of calculations in relation to probability and range and relationships. You've just done it with like a different set of moving parts, not even more moving parts, just a different set. And now I have to recalculate them all. You know, it's like I'm as annoyed as Mike is whenever I sort of see a game and it's got the Games Workshop stat block and they've just named it different things. But at the same time, there is that thing of, okay, good, we all know what that stat block is. We've all got it locked in our heads. We all approach it and we go, well, that's one for movement, that's one for close combat, that's one for shooting, that's one for how hard you hit, that's how hard you can get hit, that's how many times you can get hit until you die, and there's your save, and there's what stops you running away. We all know those numbers. They're all sort of pre-accepted. And if you give me that stat block, I don't even need to look at it to to remember that those are the stats. I don't really care what they're called, because in my head, they are still movement, weapon, skill, ballistic, skill, strength, toughness. You know, they're always going to be that, whatever you call them. But at the same time, obviously, you want your game to have a uniqueness to it. You want it to stand out from the crowd. And I mean, I read a lot of war game rule sets. I very much scan through a lot of them going, where's the thing? I only want three things is the maximum. I don't want more than three things that really differentiate your system from everybody else.
Oh, you don't?
Not really, no. I mean, beyond that, I think there's too much going. I think three pieces of genuine innovation in a game is, I would say, pretty much the upper limit of how far you want to push it in a standalone game. I really do. I think more than that, and you know, your people aren't going to be able to appreciate it. It's sort of like, you know, salt in a meal. It's like, a bit of salt is a good thing. You don't want to be sitting there with a bowl of salt and a spoon and just, you know.
Or it's like a completely new type of cuisine, and so it's going to take you a while to like enjoy olives, which are weird, and we'll get there. But
no, absolutely. And I think quite often it's sort of like, okay, I already pre-know a lot of the systems in this game. Here's the thing that it's doing that's cool. Now I can really appreciate that thing because I know what all the other stuff does. I've come across it several times. I know what noises it makes. I know how it feels on the tabletop. And now I can appreciate how the thing that this is doing differently is actually different.
You mentioned that you kind of caught this idea from board gaming. And I think that's really... that's a useful comparison, because for those of us that have purchased or been subjected to lots and lots of new board games, perhaps you, gentle listener, are a bit like Glenn and I, and tend to think that trying a new board game is probably better than playing a game that you've already played already. Then like, you end up in a pattern matching mode where you crack the thing open, you're like, oh, okay, it's got a worker placement mechanic, and it has like a victory track that's going to cost me more as I get around the back end of the victory track, and I need to, there's a clock which I need to look of, and there's some kind of tech tree, and you kind of, there might be a unique collection of those mechanics, but at least you get to learn roughly what they all do, and so you can stick them together fairly quickly without too much of a rules explanation. And so I guess in wargaming, which is equally going to be a complex beast to come together at the table, then it's the same thing. It's like, are you just creating a new recipe with the same ingredients, or are you forcing me to learn something completely new in order to operate this machine?
Exactly. And I think the point is that if you're putting in something that's a completely new and unique set of rules that don't look like any other set of rules, figure out what the upshot of those rules are, what the outcome of them is. Because as I say, if you've got a set of rules for, let's say, shooting a bow, and it has a whole different set of you know, things that are being rolled and ways that they're being modified and things I have to check, and the upshot of it is exactly the same as let's say the Games Workshop bow shooting system, that there are like three target numbers, two of which I roll, one of which you roll, and then you either get a wound or you don't, then don't make me learn a whole bunch of new systems to do that. The existing systems are perfectly good. If what you do with those systems is allow me to like bounce a bow off of a wall and then, you know, pinball it along a corridor and take out three people with it, but I have to be able to get the angle right and I have to judge degrees and the game calculates degrees for me, fine,
or if whatever that bow shot mechanic is interacts with other parts of the system, maybe there's a resource management system or there's some kind of PowerPoints system, like if it interacts with another moving piece and you needed lots of moving pieces to be sort of similar shaped or sympathetically shaped, then that's, I think, another good reason.
Yeah, I think innovation is all well and good, and you know, you don't want to just out and out rip off other systems, but this is a...
We're not going to talk about that problem, are we?
Well, no, I mean, the thing is that in truth, we are sort of writing in a medium that is quite sort of self-referential and sharing. You know, I mean, I constantly see people popping up and going, you know, oh, what if somebody takes one of my mechanics? I can't show anyone my game. They might take one of my mechanics. And the thing is, it's like, unless you've invented new forms of dice and new forms of playing cards, you've taken somebody else, a pre-existing set of mechanics, you know. Mm-hmm. However you're, you know, defining the dice, you're still using, there's somewhere in your game you're
no using, Glenn, I don't use centimeters, I use a new measurement system.
I use nano blobs, and you know, we are
micometers.
Yeah, we are fundamentally, you know, all standing on the shoulders of giants. And you know, there is obviously, I mean, I say obviously, there's a line somewhere between accepting that there are ways that things are done and ripping somebody off.
Yeah, there's a super non-obvious line.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But, you know, don't be scared about the fact that there are certain ways that certain things are done. You know, there are certain ways that movement happens and shooting happens and combat happens and et cetera, et cetera. And nobody's going to come at you with knives because you've used the version for resolving these things that there are in literally 100 rule books already.
There's a part of this conversation that I'm desperate to go to, but I'm not going to, and we'll put a pin in, which is like, my process tends to be starting with mechanics that are extremely familiar to me, and then in sort of thematic mechanic terms, like trying to make the mechanic more and more evocative of the image that I'm trying to evoke, both in my mind and the other players' minds. And so I think, like, for me, complexity budget is like, we start with almost no complexity budget because we probably lay down a foundation of completely obvious rules, like it's a skirmish game, it's a mass battle game, like whatever. And then the first thing you were trying to do is like, okay, let's pinch the clay up on the thing that I'm trying to evoke. Like, this is, you know, it's a Western, so it's got to have like quick drawing things, or it's a magical wizards game, so it's got to have really cool spells in it. And you draw that part up, and that becomes something where it's like, well, clearly there's going to be loads of specific rules around spell casting, and I'll probably start by ripping off another spell casting system, and then I'll change it. And I think that's kind of, I think where exactly you spend your complexity budget probably bleeds into another conversation about thematic mechanics and how you're ensuring that the places that you spend your most time and energy and focus are on the things that really matter to what your game is about. Mm-hmm. But I think that eschewing that part of the conversation, the point that you're making is, if I can understand everything without really even reading it, then what are the three you're suggesting little spikes of like, oh, okay, I have to scratch my head and really understand this. Hmm. And I might suggest that, like, wouldn't it be nice if those three things are things that interact and it creates this sort of fourth thing or across the top, which is this sort of haze of, ooh, this game is special because there's this magical other sort of fog that sits on top of the basic mechanics that I understand.
That seems like a good place to take a quick break.
It's an important point, again, and it's one of these things we refer back to, I think, on a fairly regular basis in these conversations, is about having some sort of design document and some sort of overarching idea. Because, you know, using the phrase complexity budget, I think budget is a very specific word there, where, you know, you're going to have a thing that you're aiming for your game to be able to do. And where you spend your budget, and it is a limited budget and you really can't go over it or you will just lose people, you need to spend that budget wisely on creating the thing you actually want to create.
Yeah.
And the thing that you actually want to create isn't just a generic skirmish game but with all different rules to everybody else's skirmish game. I mean, if that is what you want to create, please don't. It's a mad thing to want to do. You know, what you want to create is, you know,
but I like inventing dice mechanics, Glenn. I really do.
What you actually want to create is the horror game that is actually like experiencing a horror movie, or the Western that's actually like a gunfight. And if you're trying to create the Western that's actually like, you know, the gunfight at the OK Corral, don't spend complexity budget on a close combat system. You know, just use the generic close combat system, because that's not what that game is about. That game is obviously about quick drawing and gunslinging and et cetera, et cetera.
Spend
and just
it go, on what's important.
Yeah, just go, you know what, close combat, yeah, it shouldn't really happen. If it does happen, because it's going to have to at some point or another, biff, boff, there we go, let's move on from that.
So I think we probably want to talk about how you sort of solve or make things easier. I guess one thing I'll just catch on, just because you mentioned it there, like how to spot when this is going wrong. So how do you know when you may have overspent your complexity budget? So you said briefly there, like losing people, you might lose people. So clearly when you're playtesting, like, or when you're having a new board game explained to you or explaining a board game and you get to like minute 25 and everyone has like wandered off, like there's moments in board game explanation where you know you've lost people. But I think that watching for these moments during playtesting where either they are not engaging with a mechanic because it's one too many mechanics and they just can't be bothered, or, and I think this is a fairly common one from my experience, is a rule gets forgotten a lot because you've put something in which felt right, but it's outside of the complexity budget and it's also outside of the importance. So I'm a product manager, so I'm going to invent one of those XY axes. So like if something is really important and something is really complicated, like if it's really important and complicated, people will love it and engage with it and manipulate it and handle it. I mean, if it's too complicated and not important, then they'll just ignore it. They just won't even look at it. They'll forget about it.
Yeah, and I think that leads into sort of one of the next things I was going to talk about quite nicely, actually. And it's that if a certain rule is getting forgotten regularly at the tabletop, that's a great sign for a rule that's possibly prunable. Mm. And I think that one of the reasons that some rules get forgotten repeatedly is that they step outside of the story that the game is telling, and that makes it way harder to remember that rule, because one of the big things about, you know, so we said before that, well, you know,
let me just finish that idea. And I think that's because the gamer is not asking for that rule. So when you get to that point in the story and it's like, okay, so the grenade landed and it's going to explode, where's the rules for the grenade exploding? Well, here are the rules for the grenade exploding. Like if you are if a spaceship jumps in and you've just learned the rules for like how a spaceship jumps into space, then you're like, great, the spaceship jumped in, thanks for that, we now don't need to know anymore. And of course I put in a rule in A Billion Suns where it says, oh no, but wait, everyone takes some damage if they're near the jumping in spaceship. But no one was asking that question. That question wasn't being asked at the table.
Yeah, and I think, so as we've mentioned before, people have a limit to how many things they can sort of hold in their head at any given time. It's somewhere between 5 and 8 things that people are comfortable holding in short-term memory, and then they can like rehearse in short-term memory until it sort of filters into to long-term memory. Now, one of the major places that people are very good at remembering things differ from people who aren't is that they're better at chunking information. You know, putting bits of information into lumps so that they can get more information into those 6 or 7 slots. You know, so it's why when you're remembering a phone number, you don't remember it as how many digits. You remember it as a set of 3 digits and a set of 4 digits and a set of 4 digits. And then when somebody else reads your phone number out to you and they chunk it differently, your brain melts down. It's like, that sounds vaguely like my phone number, but you've ordered it as a 2, a 3, a 3, and a 3, and that's shut my head down. And our story, I mean, one of what you might call the sort of the conceit of your game is a way in which players will chunk information for you. So if a set of rules create an understandable story, A follows from B, follows from C, follows from D, and they're all things that you're expecting, you're like, okay, so I've got A, presumably something like B will happen. Oh, here's the rule for B. You know, I've fired the bow. Now the bow has to hit the thing, and then it has to wound the thing. These are things I'm expecting to find in the story. Mm. And it's one of the greatest benefits to sort of, you know, simulation elements within a game, is that they allow you to chunk rules for players so that, you know, as I say, one of the reasons that you want to sort of be careful about how much innovation that you put into a game is that when I approach a lot of war games rules as a regular war game player, I can pre-chunk 90% of the rules because I can go, yep, I know that one, that there's a combat phase. It does what the combat phase I've already come across from. There's one lump for me. I've remembered that whole thing with one fact, one chunk.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can find the way in which a set of rules tell a story, you can sort of suitcase in a whole bunch of rules into one idea or one concept. And so long as you can keep those rules intelligent and innovative and following on a sort of a logical series, it's like remembering a joke or an anecdote. You only have to remember the sort of the start, and because it reminds you of the next bit as you follow through the mind palace of that system, it's that there's that much less weight on you, and you can really save yourself a lot of that complexity budget if you allow the conceits and the simulation elements of your game to tell a story that will allow people to just hook rules onto the steps of the story and go, okay, I'll come to the next step in the story. I know that there's a rule pertaining to where the shrapnel goes, because that's what happens when a grenade goes off. Oh yeah, that's that rule. I remember how that goes. So I think that's a potentially very powerful tool to assist you in sort of saving this complexity budget for players, making sure that there's a narrative logic to the, because I think sometimes people say, you know, how do you write thematic rules? You know, people have asked, and we will at some point answer that question to some degree. And I think that the funny thing is that these things feed back and forth into each other. I don't know how to write non-thematic rules, because non-thematic rules are just going to crush people's complexity budget. You know, the game's going to fall apart. Why is this happening? Why is that going on? You know, everything feeds into each other. A thematically capable rule is a technically good rule, is an elegant rule, is a crunchy and interesting rule. It's all those things together.
I have so many questions, but this is not the moment for it.
Well, I mean, that's
well, I mean, I think it's, for me, it's things that lie outside the cinema, like the cinema that you're trying to project. Like, you know, it might be thematic for me to have a wristwatch, for my Space Marine to have a wristwatch that has a like proximity sensor and can measure range between different objects and can take the temperature. But like, I don't need any mechanics for that, because that's not part of the cinema. Like, unless I'm doing a hidden aliens thing and it's Space Hulk, like it's not part of the cinema that I'm trying to evoke on the table. And so it's not worth adding of that, any of that stuff in, and making people roll extra dice and making people remember extra rules. It's interesting, because I do think that experience of sitting down to play a new game and realizing that you mostly know how to play it already, and then something happens, and you're like, wait a minute, it seems like something happened. Is there a rule for something happening? And you look it up and it's like the something happened section of the rule. And you're like, ah, yes, the something is happening right now. And I think that you can get experience and build rule sets that do that. But I think that you have to play test a lot and watch for where people are like glancing up or looking at the rule book and saying, oh, okay, so a shell just hit this ship. Like, what's the critical hit table? And it might just be that they've learned that from other games and you want to teach them something different happens than rolling on a critical hit table. But like, they have been taught a particular narrative structure. They're looking for a pattern. And so I don't know, this is a really interesting conversation for me, because I spend a lot of my time trying to break the patterns, because I feel like a lot of these patterns just exist because people have been playing them for 30 years. And the thing that existed 30 years ago was not necessarily the best version of that, but now that it's been played so much, it's become a common pattern. But you're absolutely right, Glenn, that like where you take those battles between the default approach to rules and what you consider to be innovation or improvement is really critical and sort of iterative, because you've got to get people to learn your system, and your system, if your system is so bananas that no one can understand how to plug it into their brain, then it will, as you say, lose people.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that learning new things is painful. Nobody likes learning new things. I mean, very rarely do people enjoy learning new things.
Weird statement.
I mean, I you know, we're all existing in a world. We all know that we've played a certain number of these games. We all have. We're all aware of some of the conventions to them. And asking people to learn a totally new set of them, a totally new set of conventions. Such, you know, it's like when you see like really experimental cinema that doesn't use any of the conventions of cinema. It's hard work to watch. You know, it's like when you read a novel that doesn't use any of the sort of goes out of its way to not use any of the conventions of storytelling. It's hard work to read it. And, you know, if you're giving somebody a game particularly, which is meant to be fun, which is meant to be a way to sort of unwind and relax and enjoy yourself, and you make it really hard work for them, you have to earn that. You and the player are not to be, you know, wishy-washy, going on a little bit of a journey together. You know, you're taking them down a path of, okay, here are some rules you can make some fun out of, and they've got to trust you at various points, and they've got to believe that you're not just going to abuse them for no particularly good reason because you want to innovate and you want to do something different. They've got to go, okay, I trust this guy, you know. And I often see rule sets and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, he's picked a particularly elegant sort of pre-existing rule for this. That's nice. I know where he got that from. I respect that choice. That's lovely. Let's see where you get to the thing that I want you to do. I mean, in respect to sort of the way, you know, you sort of, we write or you write games, is a lot of times when I'm writing a game, I'll go, okay, here's the rules for the thing I want to do. This is the thing I want you to learn. This is the thing that matters. I'll write the rules for that and be quite careful and intricate, and I really care about how it works. And the rest of it, I won't literally go blah, 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 shooting phase. But I'll more or less go, if it's not a game about shooting, you know, shooting, do some shooting. Shooting there. Everyone's got a shooty stick, and the shooty stick does a one hit, and you roll a four or more to see if it hits, and if it does, it hits, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. Lovely, brilliant. There's
that's how shooting works in Gatherlands.
I mean, yeah,
because like we talked about this before, but like the shooting in Gaslands is deliberately downplayed and simple, and it doesn't have a lot of moving pieces, because I don't want people spending their time wondering how does the shooting work. I want them to be wondering how does the movement work, and going, ah, the movement is so complicated. I chose to spend a lot of the complexity budget in Gaslands on the movement phase and the skid dice and the templates and all the extra resources, because if you look at the way that the resources work in terms of the current gear and the number of hazards, blah blah blah, like all of that's linked to the movement phase. There is one resource which is hull, which is not specifically linked to the movement phase, but triggers during collisions as well as shooting, and so yeah, like almost everything's pointing at that.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas in, and I think I mentioned this before, like in A Billion Suns, like the movement phase is like whatever, like. And also the kind of shooting phase is a bit like, whatever. Like, I'm very proud of the shooting system, but it's not, it doesn't pack a bunch of complex decisions and different things in, like, all, like 80% of the complexity budget is in the mission structure and the deployment rules and the use of tokens and credits. Like,
yeah,
you're spending most of your time wondering about that. And then it's like, how do the ships move? Oh, well, you just move them, just measure eight. Can they turn? Yeah, they can turn.
Yeah, no, and I think A Billion Suns is a particularly good example, because it is outlandishly rule breaking in the way it goes about putting itself together. It's you know, almost excessively innovative in several very core points about the way you deploy, about what you get to deploy, and about what you're trying to achieve. And there's literally, as I say, there's like three things there that are massively, incredibly innovative. And so the rest of it is kind of like, it's okay, calm down. It's okay. Look at the shooting phase. And then you look at the shooting phase, like, oh, this is lovely. This is so, you know, like, very nice, you know. Here's the movement phase. Oh, my God, this is a delightfully simplistic movement phase, because that's not what the game cares about. The game cares about giving you this brain-shatteringly sort of tricky thing about what to deploy and where to deploy and where to drop your pressure on the tabletop and et cetera. Mm. And once you've achieved that, it goes, okay, all right, now you can relax. Trust me, I'll take you through these other bits. They're okay. They advertise fairly clearly that they're not something you need to sort of sweat over too heavily, you know. And I think this is, like I say, one of the things about a set of rules that are the standardized versions is that they're another way of signaling to your players, what your game is about, what you're trying to do, what you care about, and therefore what they should care about. It's a way of signposting to them where the fun moments of the game are, you know, what the bits that they should be focusing on, and what the bits that when they focus on them will give them the best rewards. So I think all these things, you know, again, as I say quite a few times, are ways of helping your players out, signposting them to the points that where the good stuff is, you know, helping them to go, look, well, wait till we get hit there. Now look at what I've done here. That's where you're going to have something really shiny happen. Don't worry too much about this. This is the blah, blah.
And with that, we'll take a quick break.
You can almost measure this in terms of like the number of words that you've written in a particular section in your rule book. Like I'm always conscious about like the thickness of these rule books that we write. And, you know, the fact that you're asking a player to inhale all of this information where, like, if I get a board game rule book and it's longer than 8 pages, like, I'm angry at that board game.
But
it's quite reasonable to expect a war game to have, you know, 64 pages of rules or something. And so I think, you know, thinking about it almost in terms of like, how many pages do I have to read to understand like how the turn structure works? Is it half a page? Because that's probably a good thing, unless the turn structure is just integral to the reason that this heist simulator war game works. Now, Glenn, you defined the difference between complexity budget and cognitive load thusly. Let's see if I can recall it. So complexity budget is how much newness and learning and innovation are you putting into your rules system so that when I pick up the rule book to Glenn's wonderful new miniature skirmish game, how much are you asking me to learn fresh versus just kind of going back to my existing knowledge of systems that look a bit like this and understanding sort of how 80% of the game already works just by glancing at it, but you've spent your complexity budget carefully on the bits of this game that really matter, the bits about pirates falling sideways because the boat is rocking, and we don't worry so much about the bits where they shoot their flintlock rifles. That's all super easy and as you'd expect. And so you contrasted, I think, nicely complexity budget with cognitive load. Which I think I've been using those two terms interchangeably, but for the sake of having a useful distinction, cognitive load for this conversation is going to mean what are you asking the player to think about, make decisions about, calculate in their meat computer, in their meat-based rules computer, whilst actually playing the game. So we'll assume that, broadly speaking, all the players at the table understand how the game is supposed to be played and how are they making strategic decisions and tactical decisions and moment-to-moment in-game decisions, and where are you asking them to spend that time? And I will somewhat throw my hand a little bit and say, are you asking them to do a bunch of mathematics in order to establish what the target number of a dice roll is? Or are you asking them to think about where are they going to spend their resource and should they hold this resource back or should they place it? And I think, as we'll talk about as well, like, am I spending a lot of time trying to figure out what is even happening on this table filled with miniatures versus making clever decisions about what I'm going to do or what I think you're about to do and how I'm going to counter it? Is that about the shape of it?
Yeah, I think basically. So I think that two of the big sort of demons to slay for cognitive load are sort of calculating and bookkeeping.
Yep.
So talk a bit about those. So this is this is about making sure that the brain space that your players have is being spent on the crunchy, interesting puzzles that are fun to engage with, as opposed to doing math. You know, you don't ultimately want your players to be coming to the tabletop and multiplying 8 by 14, you know, repeatedly, and that's what's taking up the vast majority of their brain space. You want them to be looking at visual spatial relationships and figuring out tactical ways of outwitting the other person, and yeah, giving them a cognitive load that is the cool stuff rather than all the baloney.
And I want to catch on that, because that's a great point. I want to catch on that and just dig on that kind of at a high level here, which is when you're when you're making things that people are going to interact with, there's this idea of usability. And like, there's a classic statement, which is don't make me think. I think it's a, there's even a book entitled it, which is like, when you're building a task-based design for something, like try and figure out what it is that the person is trying to get done and make it really, really easy so that when I walk into the ER, I can just see where I go and tell someone that I've broken my arm. Or when I load up a web page to buy a shoe, it's really clear to me where shoes are and how I buy them. And that don't make me think thing isn't actually what you want in a war game, because you do want people to think. You do want them to spend their time thinking about things. The important thing is, what are they spending their time thinking on? Are they cross about the fact that they have to add 700 numbers together, or are they thinking about the clever trick that they're going to do because they figured out what you're going to do because you believe they figured out what you're going to do next, and so forth and so on. So it's kind of interesting because it doesn't adhere to the normal usability rules. But I think some of the usability rules really come strongly out, which is, so you started talking there about bookkeeping and what I refer to as game state, which is like, how easy is the situation to read? Like, and I think part of that is like, how much are you as a games designer providing to your players in terms of widgets and ding-dongs and boxes to tick and suggested ideas for how to manage all the complexity that's floating around in the game? Because if you glance at the table and there's a load of hidden information or missing information, that can be really difficult, because then you're using your brain to like, oh, did he have 6 wounds or 7 wounds? I can't remember. So then everyone has to put dice down and tokens down and blah blah blah, and then your table is a sea of tokens and dice and it doesn't look right, and you're not kind of in the narrative anymore because it just looks like it looks really a lot like a game. But also then you have to look at all those numbers and think about all those numbers, and so for example, like how many variable statistics, how many resources are there that each model can have? And I think probably we'll want to talk a little bit about, we kind of touched on this before, but like the number of models and the detail that you go to are clearly, they're obviously linked. There's no, it's not genius to say that. But that's also because as you're looking and analyzing the state of the board, like I don't want to know, of all of the Space Marines, I don't want to know which of them has got 6 shoelaces done up, their shoelaces done up to 6, and which has got the shoelaces done up to 7, and that gives them a quarter of an inch more movement. Like that's too much detail.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the interesting things. I was reading a book recently about designing war games, where they sort of said the scale of the minis and the tabletop kind of don't matter. It's kind of just a personal aesthetic choice. We have X many operating things on a given tabletop that can do X many things in a turn and take X amount of punishment. It doesn't really matter if it's 50 guys in a unit or one guy at, you know, because we're operating a different scale, so that one guy can take 50 hits at a different level as opposed to the unit. You tend to ask players to engage with roughly the same number of activatable objects in any given game. There's not a huge amount of
we talked about this 3 or 4 episodes ago, and we talked about the 7 ± 2. So like if I play a game of Warhammer 40,000 Apocalypse, like the game designers of the most recent Apocalypse have very cleverly grouped together all of your models so that there's only really 7 or 9 like blobs that move around, and when I activate something it's only 1 of 7 or 9 blobs. Then there's a bit of detail that I have to zoom in and so forth. But yeah, whether it's 7 cowboys or whether it's 7 absolutely monstrous regiments of goblins, it's still 7 things that I have to worry about the position of and the status of, and
The number of models you have in a Malifaux warband and the number of units you have in a Warhammer army are roughly the same number of things, because that's about, you know, where people can handle when things are going well dealing with things. So I think there's a term that's often used. It's a little bit of jargon that you hear from gamers, and that's sort of being able to grok the tabletop, and I do like it. I think it's a programming term, And that's about whether you can look at the tabletop, you can look at the game state and you can understand it, you can read it, whatever term you want to use for it, just by standing there next to the table, you can understand what's going on with everything. All the conventions are visible to you, things aren't hidden off the tabletop. And I think that's part of the, let's say, the first of these two sort of big issues for getting your cognitive load in the right place. And that's about how you deal with bookkeeping at the tabletop. You never want to ask a player to have to remember an uninteresting or unimportant number and just hold it in their head. It's a pointless feat, you know, to test somebody's memory in this sort of game. If there's a number that persists from one turn to another that relates to something on the tabletop, you need to have a way of noting it, of letting people perform bookkeeping.
Now, this is one of the intriguing differences between board games, which are pre-packaged component products, and miniature war games, which tend to be DIY systems, because I think whilst I agree with what you're saying, because from a usability point of view, like, provide some mechanism for the player to be able to actually record that, I think a lot of systems, rightly or wrongly, just sort of assume that you'll figure that out. Now, Gaslands doesn't. It provides boxes with check boxes that you record your hull, and it gives you little printable hazard tokens, and it tells you to put a D6 in a square that's exactly shaped for a small D6. But a game like Malifaux has an absolutely batshit variety of different tokens and states and burning and poison and unique things that come off every model. And like, the game just says, you know, you have, like, you know, squelching in your pants +3 condition, like, record that somehow. And I don't know if they just assume everyone's got whiteboard markers and laminated cards, or they just assume that everyone is paying hundreds of pounds to print, like, custom laser cut tokens. But I'm sure, boy, howdy, do I end up with a lot of laser cut tokens whilst playing that game. And I think that, much as I love that game, I think that's a really tremendous example of being sympathetic to the fact that you are a mostly do-it-yourself war game, where I might, for example, buy some miniatures from you, but if you don't sell me a set of componentry to record the state which you are asking me to record, like, are you actually just asking me to spend a bunch of my time thinking about, how did we record wounds again? I can't remember. We use dice. It's just easier. Okay, do you count up or do you count down? I count up. Oh, okay, all right. I'll change the way that I do it because this is the way that you do it. And all of that, like, you know, just give me a free download that I can print off that just has some boxes and I can use a pencil. Like, paper and pencil are pretty easy. And even if you just say pencil and paper, like, and you explain how people are going to do it, like, I think this is, in terms of bookkeeping, I guess my observation is I don't see enough games just making it transparent how the designer expects you to keep track of all these things.
Yeah. Like I said, I've got a pack of Guild Ball widgets here for noting various states in Guild Ball. And that, to be fair, is a game with a very static number of acting unit, you know, elements on the tabletop. You literally can't go above a certain number, and they all have to, you know, sort of fit into these certain slots. And so it gets away with a lot of those. I think what's interesting about Malifaux, since you mentioned it, is that the first edition of Malifaux didn't have all the status effects that it now has. The original version of Malifaux, the first book, I think had poison and maybe defensive stance to note. And that was, I'm not even sure it had defensive stance. And then they introduced burning. And then they introduced...
And they provided little circles that you coloured it, little bullet holes that you coloured in on the cards to record wounds.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting that there, you know, and if you come to Malifaux now as a brand new player, the fact that you're going to have to sometimes note like 8 different status effects that all interact in different ways and are turned off in different ways is brain flattening in the sort of the cost that it takes of you. But I think they got away with it because they took players, it came in one step at a time. Maybe that's a question about bloat or something else that we can refer to. But
I don't know. I mean, I think in terms of cognitive load, like, I think I think unlike complexity budget, I actually think that cognitive load potentially has different ceilings depending on your players or depending on the expectations that you set on the game. Maybe this is true of complexity budget as well, but like, I have learnt certain games ask more of me. And so I don't bring them to the table when I'm tired and it's the end of the week and I've had a real tough week and I'm, you know, haven't been sleeping well. Like, I'll bring something that I know has a lower cognitive load. And that lower cognitive load may be partnered with a less satisfying strategic experience, but it may be that it's an equally satisfying narrative experience, but as a player I'm happy to in one situation I'm happy to go, right, I am up for a 3-hour absolute brain scratcher versus, you know what, I just want 90 minutes of like pushing this guy forward and pushing that guy forward and rolling some dice and finding out if they beat the snot out of each other.
I mean, I would take the position, and I would argue, in particularly in relation to game design,
mm-hmm.
that a game that has a high number of moving parts is not necessarily a game that's inherently going to be offering more to a player. The fact that it has a heavy cognitive load and you've got to track a lot of moving pieces often makes you feel like, you know, you're doing a lot, but there is a lot of it sometimes it's just cognitive busy work.
That's true.
I mean, genuinely, and you know, and I'm quite good at that kind of cognitive busy work, and quite often I come across games that generate these sense of complexity and mental intricacy by just making you do this cognitive busy work. And because I happen to have a higher capacity for that than a lot of people, those games are just unbelievably crushingly dull and transparent, where we're just doing busy work. Of course it's that, and it's that, and then it's that. I mean, where's the weight to it? It's like, well, the weight to it is that you've got to track 4 or 5 different moving parts that will have numbers attached. Yeah, I happen to have a freakish ability to do that. If that's all it is, that's just the most boring, dull experience I can possibly imagine.
As you're speaking there, I think one area in war games where you can add a bunch of cognitive load during play, because I'm actually thinking about this in terms of the game that you and I were playing last night, which we were playing some Arkham Horror. And Arkham Horror, the card game, tends to introduce new mechanics and make you solve rules interactions in a very dynamic way. And the equivalent for that in wargaming is either having a broad spectrum of models that interact together in very intriguing ways, like a kind of War Machines Horde type situation, or having a very broad range of scenarios where each scenario brings a very different way of approaching victory, such as in something like A Billion Suns, where a lot of the head scratching at the table is like, how do I win? What is even the condition for winning here? Or what are the situations that I need to sit up? And in some regards, like, it's perfectly possible to create a system where, as you say, like, you're doing a lot of work to figure out how do I even win, but that work is not leading to a satisfying experience of solving a puzzle. It's simply like churning through some meat in order to get to the end of that.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, and as I say, in relation to bookkeeping, if you're asking players to hold in their head a given state of a given model, and states, I think, particularly are one of the worst offenders in this. I think that wounds, people are used to tracking things like wounds and et cetera, et cetera. But states are a nightmare because they have, each of them has slightly different rules, interactions attached to them. Oh, you're on fire, you've got to roll on the ground to put yourself out. Oh, but you've got acid on you, you've got to roll in muddy ground to counteract the acid. Oh, you've got pee in your hair, you've got to, you know.
This is the sort of thing that computer games are really good at. And
yeah, absolutely.
Humans are really terrible at.
And the thing of it is I think that if the game says, okay, whoever is best at holding all those states in their heads simultaneously in their interactions gets a significant advantage or even wins, you're basically, it's basically the mental equivalent of sort of saying to somebody, okay, it's a running race, but you've got to keep these plates spinning next to the side of the track. Who cares about the plate spinning? No one cares about the plate spinning, but if they fall off, you lose. We're trying to see who can run fastest. We're just unnecessarily adding in this plate spinning malarkey just to see if, because the running's too easy. And it's like, I don't want to be spinning these plates. And I accept people might want to, but I think personally, you know, it's worth being very careful about what bookkeeping you ask people to do and the value of that cognitive load that you're putting on people for things like states, for things like, and I think this conversation came up in relation to degradation mechanics that we mentioned before.
Yeah. Is
how the degradation kicks in and how it affects a certain model and which level the model is at the certain time. I just think you really have to earn something for it, and it has to be something more than just putting mental pressure on your players to see which of the donkeys collapses first. And the, you know, the person who's still standing with their brain not smushed under the weight of it. Yeah, I won. I have a more resilient brain spine. And victory is mine.
We'll be back in just a second.
We'll move on slightly from bookkeeping to talk about its near neighbour, calculations and asking people to do calculations at the tabletop. Now, I think the one rule of thumb I have in relation to making people do calculations is try and keep calculations on the output end of what's happening at the tabletop. If there's an input calculation, which is what I mean by that is, if somebody has to do some basic maths in order to understand the chances of what they're doing succeeding, or whether a particular plan or tactic is a good plan or tactic to adopt, try and keep that maths relatively simple. Because they're going to have to do it in their head privately without letting the other person know that they're doing it in order to keep the game interesting.
Yeah, so this is just to reiterate that, this is like, in terms of if you're asking your players to calculate things, try and keep that away from the decision making end of the system, because I need to be sitting there looking at things going, okay, I want to consider 12 different situations or 8 different tactics simultaneously, and I don't want every one of those 8 scenarios to involve me doing a bunch of maths. I want to be able to feel them.
Yeah, and then once the thing has occurred and the dice have been rolled and everything has come out on the table, you can make it fairly mathsy and put some calculations in there, you know, because everybody can join in and do that maths together. You know, once the dice are out there and there's a thing and it's just a set of mechanical operations in order to, you know, go through the steps to regulate it out, we can all join in and we can all do it as a team, and we can check each other's answers. So I think you have much.
Glenn, can you give us a worked example of that to demonstrate, like, because in some regards, like having a bunch of modifiers on a dice roll, like that's an output complexity in terms of calculation. But like, in order to understand how I come to that, like what's a method of not forcing me to do all of that maths up front to understand the chances of success?
I mean, I think a lot of games do this on a basic level. So for example, we were talking earlier about the shooting in Gaslands. Let's just take that as an example. The shooting in Gaslands is that it's a 4+ to hit, and then a 6, you know, 6 to save, and 6s are criticals. Now, realizing that if you're rolling 10 dice, a 4+ means you're going to get about 5 hits, and then probably one of them's going to be a crit, and they'll probably save the crit because you're rolling 6s, they're rolling 6s. It's around 10 dice, probably even out, probably around about 5 hits, more or less in the ballpark. Then when you roll the dice, you know, you've then got hull damage, which can cause something to be destroyed and cause it to flip and cause it to blow up. When it blows up, it hits five different things, and all of them roll different dice, and all those dice give things hazards, and the hazards cause things to wipe out, might cause other things to blow up. It's like, my decision to shoot you is based on a relatively simple set of calculations. You know, I have to halve the number of hits, and then for every six dice rolled, add one on or take one off. That's fairly simple. The mechanics of then enacting that, and the explosion of exponential results to it, and the dice that I have to do, and then, oh, okay, I've hit you, you've blown up. How do the exploding rules work? Well, we can all join in and find the exploding rules, because that's a joint operation. We're all, you know, operating that part of the machine. We're all joining in to make that work through. You know, we try and keep the bit that you have to privately decide as low on calculations and rules and load and problems. You just have to go, is this a good idea? Is this a good decision or not? And then when things get rolled and calculated out, and, you know, like I say, in Warhammer, it's that thing of, okay, you know, I've got X many dice, and then you roll X many dice, and I've got special interactions from my unit, and this spell has done this other thing to you. Those are all things we can do as a communal act of calculation and mathsing out, as opposed to the way that you make the decision can be more sort of loose and ballparky, and yeah, it's pretty much about the right idea and do it. And you don't have to go, okay, I have to actually count all the numbers up. I'm rolling 20 dice and I'm looking for fours. Well, everyone can do that. We can join in and do that. We can all look for fours together. And then we can go, is it threes and then sixes? No, it's threes and then fives, because you're on toughness and I've on, oh yeah, I forgot about your extra pip of strength from your halberd and whatever it is. So but that's what I mean by trying to make sure that the more massy, addy, calculatey, looking at numbers bit is something that can be done a bit more communally, and the bit that you need to do to actually make your decisions you can do in your head without being crushed by the weight of it. And I think one that pushes the envelope on this, the thing that we've mentioned before, is, like, for example, Infinity. Infinity asks you to do quite a lot of quite mathsiness in your head to make decisions that you really can't reveal to the other person that you're doing. And also
what's deeply difficult is that they ask you to make, I mean, this is kind of intrinsic in the system, but they ask you to make them in sort of split second moments. So when I make a short action to move from one place to another, and I'm about to make another short action to make a subsequent move, in that heartbeat, I have an opportunity to say, I'm going to shoot you. And so, like, I didn't necessarily know that you were going to cross my line of sight, but knowing now that you cross that line of sight, I need to make an instant decision about whether my D20 plus 8 plus 6 minus your 3 plus my other 3 for the ammunition that I can select is sufficient to get against your D20 with your camo that's minus 6 with your plus 3 because of the, and it's like, that's so much maths to do in like 1 second that it's like you actually have to ask the opposing player, could you mind just holding your second action for a minute, because I just need to scratch my head for a hot second here.
And I think the thing is,
it's a great example actually,
and I think part of the point is that Infinity revels in that. It's almost proud of the fact that it puts that weight on you. And what I would say is there's not a large niche for games that can get away with asking that of you. And I think Infinity might have already filled it, so maybe leave them to it and try something else. But generally, yeah, the version that Infinity asks of you, I think, is, you know, a very specific and bespoke piece of filigreed speciality, and I think you would be unwise to attempt to replicate that. I think that most of us have to go down that more Gaslands end of it, of waiting until it's public information before we ask a lot of emergent complexity to be dribbled onto the top of the dance.
And I think maybe to loop these two conversations back on each other, like, the good thing about deploying your complexity budget in areas where it really matters to the game is that everywhere that you have not spent your complexity budget, everywhere that you have used mechanics which are extremely familiar to the player, they'll have instincts already baked in about what a good decision looks like from their other experiences of playing games. And so the complexity budget has a direct impact on the cognitive load during play, which is, if I can see a couple of like weapon skill numbers and strength and toughness numbers, and I can basically see what the outcome of that combat is going to be through my experience, then I can make that decision making in a very instinctual sort of experience based way. And then I can spend my time thinking about what I'm going to do with all of these magical cards that you've given me in your special system.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the rule of thumb here, again, and this tracks back to the complexity budget conversation, is figure out the things that you want your players to be thinking about. Give them as many easy ways of noting and getting around the things that you don't want them to think about. And the things you probably shouldn't be asking them to think about is, can you do basic math at a tabletop whilst under the pressure of somebody else throwing dice at your head? That's not a particularly delightful question to have answered, you know, and if it is going to get answered, it'll get answered pretty quickly, and we'll know in about 4 minutes who it is that's best at doing that, and then we can move on to doing something more interesting with our time. Try and ask them, you know, better questions and help them out to not have to answer the less interesting ones. You know, give them ways out, give them ways of efficiently bookkeeping states, you know, don't ask them to do too much bookkeeping. Let them be able to look at the tabletop and with one sweep of their eyes understand the things you want them to be able to understand at that point, which might not be the same for every game, and it might not be the same for your design as everybody else's, but there is something you want them to be able to grok instantly. Make sure they can do it, you know, and if you want something to be hidden from them at that point, go ahead and hide it, but you know, keep track of which those
but don't hide it because it's painful to work it out.
Don't, because some scumbag,
that's just very frustrating. Yeah, because some scumbag will see through it, and for everyone else it'll just be very frustrating and exhausting.
Yeah. Don't make a number hidden just because it requires somebody to memorize it and then base some part of your game on them not having memorized it, because somebody's gonna have memorized it and they're gonna ruin your game. You know, if it's useful to memorize it, just have it be open information, you know. Okie dokie. I think that's a sufficient chat on this particular subject. If you've watched to this point, I assume that you enjoyed watching us talk about this subject. If so, please like and subscribe. If you don't think that this was a sufficient level of chattery about this particular subject, let us know. We can and will talk more about it. We can and will talk more about almost anything. this chat was in response to a comment on a different chat, as I sort of mentioned. So if there's something you'd like us to talk about, if there's something that this conversation has sparked within your brain and you'd like to see us delve into, please let us know. Drop a comment. We will talk about almost anything, certainly anything to do with tabletop miniatures.
I will literally discuss which of my Chaos Call of Cthulhu RPG scenarios is my favorite.
We will talk about pretty much anything, you know, in relation to games design. So if you have a question, if you have anything, have a specific or you know, to do with your design, if it will be useful to have us chat about it, please let us know. Drop it into the comment section. But for now, look us up on social media, reach out to us. We love to hear your comments and feelings and ideas and suggestions. For this moment, however, we're going to say goodbye and sign off in this episode of Rule of Carnage. So goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.